kids. Bat Segundo here, and I don't understand why this Ken Alder guy finds the lie detector objectionable. I understand it to be a scientific measure still quite active in the United States, and yet people resist it. Years ago, when I was going through a lengthy divorce trial, my attorney had the bright idea to give my now ex-wife a polygraph test, where she revealed her cunning plans to rob me of my savings and, of course, my pride. Unfortunately, this evidence was not acceptable in court, and when my attorney insisted on presenting it, like a dutiful esquire, he was disbarred, and I was left to defend myself. Alas, speculative gusto is a poor substitute for a command of the law, and I lost my case. Had people understood the lie detector, I might have lived an altogether different life.
Okay, so I am here with Ken Alder, the author of The Lie Detectors. Ken, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. I wanted to first of all ask you about the beginnings of this book, because I know you teach history at Northwestern, and I know that Northwestern also had a lie detector labs. Was it that particular propinquity that actually caused you to have this interest in lie detection?
No, actually, it's not. It's sort of weird to have ended up studying a subject that had a lot to do with my own institution where I work, Northwestern, which had the first crime lab, the first scientific crime lab in the country. And actually, another part of the story takes place in Berkeley, where I grew up. I'm from Berkeley. So, but that, weirdly enough, has nothing to do with how I chose this subject. It was just accident.
Complete serendipity. It just happened to take place in locations that you grew up in.
Well, that's how it feels to me. I mean, maybe there's some deep psychological reason I can't discern, but that's really an accident.
Well, so then how exactly did the lie detector interest start?
Well, you know, it's such a bizarre claim. I mean, there are different kinds of historians of science, and some historians of science go after the people who have the really big ideas and figure out why these great novel ideas like Darwin or Einstein transformed the world. And I do the opposite, almost. I'm interested in the history of the banal, those things that are so ubiquitous as almost to be invisible. We don't even notice them anymore. And lie detectors in this country are just sort of part of the landscape, and yet we're the only country in the world that uses them. It's such a bizarre claim if you think about it. You know, science is this mechanism or method we have for getting at the truth. And here's the biggest possible claim you could have, that this machine actually records whether or not somebody is telling the truth. And it seemed to cut so directly at what science was and yet be on its face so absurd that I guess I was just tempted.
I wanted to actually ask you, why do you think so many people believe in this junk science? I mean, it's not admissible in a courtroom. It still, as you point out in the book, continues to this very day, you know?
Yeah, it gets a huge purchase on the American imagination. It sort of builds over time. I don't know that people are all that credible about it at first, but over time it becomes this fixture in the American popular imagination. And the idea, I think, at bottom is, well, the appeal of it is that a machine could do the determination of guilt or innocence. It seems fair. You know, we trust our machines. They're honest in a way that human beings aren't. And so if we could use a machine to make people honest, that would be so appealing. I mean, wouldn't it be lovely to have justice be swift, sure, and fair? And it's that appeal of the machine and machine's intrinsic fairness, I think, that's part of the appeal.
Yeah. You had mentioned earlier, again, that the United States is the biggest sort of user of lie detectors, but you also observe in the book later that also America's closest allies, Canada, West Germany, South Africa, Japan, and Israel, they began using the lie detectors in the 1950s and the 1960s. Now, this can't just be this sort of ideology that you are sort of suggesting here. It has to be something else. I mean, what do you think accounts for this? These particular countries, these particular sort of locales, or authorities in these locales using the lie detector?
Yeah, that comes out of close national security relationships with the United States. I mean, by this point, the lie detector begins early in the century, early in the 20th century. But by the middle of the 20th century, the period of the Cold War, the lie detector is being used by the national security state, part of McCarthyism, part of protecting America's nuclear secrets. It's used to protect the Manhattan Project. And basically, it's at that point that, you know, the military police in Germany and occupied Germany and Japan and then in Israel, those close national security allies take it up too.
So you're saying it's just basically a sort of national security relations, that there's no sort of, like, I guess, sweeping cultural fixation upon, like, yes, we can use a machine to get the witness to tell the truth. You know?
Well, in the United States, it's definitely both. But remember, it's really used in limited ways in other countries. I mean, the United States is the only country that's made it into, like, daytime TV show, theater, or that's used it in criminal investigations so regularly, or used it for many, many years in employment. Basically, in order to get a job, you had to pass a lie detector test. And until, like, 1988, the law of the land was that in a private employment setting, you could be administered a polygraph on a regular basis for no reason at all.
Well, let's talk about this whole coercion aspect of the lie detector. One of the interesting observations was that in this book is that the CIA seem to be very fond of polygraphs. They have all of their agents tested by lie detectors. They train their agents to actually pass a polygraph test. Why do you think that, you know, this is? Is it more of did you detect, I guess, any evidence that indicated that they believed in the science of the lie detection, or was it more of a kind of coercive tool? I didn't quite determine anything from your book if you discovered anything like that.
Well, it's hard to get at what the CIA thinks about almost anything. You're going on the basis of kind of outcomes. And one of the very famous stories about the CIA and the lie detector involved Aldridge Ames, right, who was, you know, one of the great traitors of late 20th century American life. And, you know, he'd been a CIA operative, obviously double-crossing the CIA for many years. And, of course, was tested and vetted by the CIA on polygraphs on a regular basis and presumably passed them. At the same time, of course, the CIA is training him how to beat lie detector test, so it's kind of like not so surprising that he passed. Why the CIA uses it? I mean, in a weird mirror image world that they're living in the 1950s, where they see the Soviet Union and the United States as sort of mirror images of one another, everything that the CIA does is sort of with the presumption that the Soviets are doing the same thing on the other side, even when they're not. And the presumption is the Soviet Union is developing all these new psychotropic techniques for mind-altering drugs, transforming human behavior. You know, think Manchurian Candidate, basically. And so the lie detector is brought on within the CIA because they think the Soviets are doing it in part, even though they're not. It's a completely American obsession. And at the same time, also, I think it's kind of emotional training. I mean, think of it in terms of, like, biofeedback. It's a way to sort of make their agents cool and calm and collected.
Yeah. It's almost also perhaps like sort of a kind of mini Cold War going on, perhaps. The thing is all of the technological quests, I mean, there's just this crazy sort of quest by Larson, by Keeler, in this book to sort of come up with the ultimate way of making this the dominant technology. But at the same time, again, we haven't really sort of discussed the coercive aspect of strapping someone to a machine, measuring their emotional indicators, and then essentially sort of saying, well, if you don't answer this, then that means you're lying, and therefore but in many cases, it actually got people to confess in a sort of coercive way. But why, I mean, maybe you can sort of describe how this coercive aspect kind of came into play.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the two guys who are the originator of the machine. They're both operating out of Berkeley, California in the 20s. One's John Larson. He's a cop, but he also has a PhD in physiology from Berkeley. And then there's his colleague, a young high school go-getter named, an amateur magician named Leonard Keeler. And what's interesting, what I do in the book, is look at their two careers, how they begin as collaborators and divide. And really, their different ways they treat the lie detector tells us a lot about the kind of lie detector we end up with, this coercive one in particular you're speaking of. And that's really the creation of Leonard Keeler. What he does is show how you can use the lie detector to extract confessions. You can put people in situations, and he teaches cops and prosecutors how to do this in courses, how to basically, intimidate people to make them think that if you don't take this test, you know, we're going to prosecute you, you're going to stay in jail, make it so that they really sort of feel they have to take the test. And then, once they're taking the test, you confront them with, like, the evidence of their body's betrayal. And you say, look, science has seen through you. You should confess. And according to these unpublished surveys that Keeler conducted, the kind of surveys the police do not want publicized, but they can get 60% confession rates, which is really quite impressive. I mean, 60%. What makes it so successful is, you know, as you said earlier, lie detector evidence is banned from the court, right? So you cannot use it in a criminal trial. But how many cases go to trial? 90% of court cases are 90% of criminal indictments are resolved short of trial. They're results from plea bargains.
Yes.
And that's what Keeler is so brilliant at. He sells the lie detector, develops the lie detector for use in this new form in the 20s and 30s, this new form of plea bargaining, which is a kind of negotiated and coercive arrangement between a prosecutor and a defendant. You know, it's, in many cases, the prosecutor clearly has the upper hand. As a defendant's in jail, if you want to get out of jail quick, you take the test. That's what the prosecutor says. And then they try to get you to confess with high success rates.
But if it wasn't the lie detector, it would be something else, because it would be waterboarding or something. I mean, I'm wondering why you didn't sort of focus in on this American mentality of like, oh, well, we've got to go ahead and trick the person who we have in the questioning room to actually confess something.
Well, in a sense, I do go into it. I mean, the thing about the lie detector is it's a story of good intentions in some ways gone awry.
Yeah.
I mean, the Larson's lie detector, the other guy's lie detector, was an attempt to basically use lie detection as a substitute for police violence. It's a substitute for the kind of physical torture, third degree, as they called it, that the police were notorious for in the 1920s. And both of these two men have a patron, August Vollmer, who's the police chief of Berkeley, California. He's the one that sponsors their investigations.
Also a man with great intentions.
Absolutely. And his intention is to create a professional police force. He wants the police themselves to be law-abiding. And, you know, Larson tries to fulfill that obligation. But it's Keeler that really turns the device into a kind of instrument the police want to use. Okay, so it's not physical torture anymore. It's not the third degree. But now it's psychological torture. It's a kind of intimidation and coercion. But in this new domain, the domain of, you know, psychological torture. And frankly, the CIA, this is now back to the story you were referring to earlier, in the 50s, develops its techniques of true psychological torture, stress test positions, sensory deprivation, you know, creating fear of physical harm. Those forms of psychological coercion that are akin to torture are developed under the rubric of lie detection.
I wanted to also point out that with Keeler, Larson, and Vollmer, there were some interesting aspects to their personal relationships that you actually bring up. For example, Larson and Keeler, well, they met their wives by strapping them to the lie detector. And with Vollmer, there was a sort of kind of paternalistic sort of relationship between Vollmer and these two guys. So I'm wondering if this kind of close-knit aspect, I mean, maybe you could describe how this led to this, you know, grand initiation of this lie detector device, sort of camaraderie, fraternity, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, one of the things that's I wanted to do in the book was sort of show how these creators of the lie detector, in a way, having this box that allowed them to think that they could go around and decide who they could trust and who they couldn't trust, made them very paranoid. And they all sort of, their personal lives are completely warped by the machine. Larson, in his very first case, ends up strapping down 20 sorority sisters. I mean, this is really the case that he uses to prove the lie detector's effective. Is he's in a Berkeley, goes into a Berkeley sorority where there's an inside job, and he wants to figure out, you know, this is a really good controlled experiment from his point of view to figure out who's the guilty party among these 20 young women. He straps them down one after the other. Well, he begins with the victim because he wants a control, a scientific neutral, a kind of control of whether or not, you know, the guilty person responds differently. A year later, he ends up marrying this woman, the first woman he ever interrogates on the lie detector. And in the end, the last person he interrogates, this woman who, you know, reacts with fury and indignation at being examined on the lie detector, stands up, tries to rip the paper in half, flees the room. The police put a tail on her, and she's brought in and finally does confess to the crime. What Larson ends up realizing is, you know, she may not actually have been guilty, even though she confessed. She retracted the confession, and she suffered from mental delusions. And that springs all his doubts about his own machine. And he basically spends his whole life trying to corral the monster he's created. For Keeler, again, he meets his wife through the lie detector. He meets her at Stanford. They're both undergraduates. They're both psych majors in the 20s. And actually, he's very clever. Keeler has this way of tricking people into thinking the lie detector works very effectively called the card trick. He makes you pick a card, any card, while you're strapped in the machine. And then he flips them over one by one. And you're supposed to deny in each instance that it's your card. And the test has basically two goals. One is it gets a reading of what it's like when you lie. Yeah. So he has that to compare with future lies. But it also convinces you that he can catch you telling a lie, right? But Keeler would only pull off this this card trick by himself using his prowess as an amateur magician. He marked the deck, basically. Well, his wife, the woman he meets on Lie Detector, beats the card test the first time out because she cheats right back. She refuses to look at the card at all. And then later on in her life, she actually cheats on Keeler. She betrays him, sleeps with many men, and eventually leaves him for another man. He takes solace in drink and dies at the age of 45, a broken man.
Well, this is an interesting aspect, too, to the book in the sense that there is this kind of subjugation of women here, and there's also this subjugation also in other instances of race, of pretty much anything that isn't sort of the Caucasian male hard line. And I guess is this kind of a natural, do you feel this is a natural outlet when you have a sort of police force trying to use technology or even recruit other people to use technology?
Absolutely. I mean, consistently, the subjects of these early lie detector investigations are either African American or women, and there's a sort of implicit presumption that these are emotional. These are emotional types, whereas the interrogator, the person with the box, and it's inevitably a he, and inevitably a white he, is cool and objective. And in a way, though, it's what allows this. The box is what allows this man, this white man, to remain objective as he goes into sororities, right? As he goes into places where otherwise, you know, he might be a little distracted by what's going on in the room, by his emotions and carried away. The box helps him maintain his objectivity. Although that's a ruse. In fact, behind the box, the examiner, in fact, is exercising enormous discretion.
Got you. I read a story in the Chicago Tribune in which you encountered Fred Hunter, the longtime president of the Illinois Polygraph Society. I was quite amused by this. He even hooked you up to a polygraph. Now, the thing I wanted to actually ask you about, and it relates also to your book, in the article, Hunter had to confess that the lie detector is not a perfect tool, but he noted that used within parameters, it's a great tool to use. I'm wondering if Hunter ever elaborated to you what these sort of parameters were, or whether you can kind of tell about what are the parameters that the people who were the polygraph boosters kind of actually sort of laid down.
Yeah. He didn't really elaborate in that interview where I was, but basically they think it works at getting confessions. I mean, they think it's an investigative tool. And you know, some of the operators are pretty honest about it, and Fred Hunter was pretty honest about how you use it in practice as a way to, you know, intimidate or trick people into confessing. Police are allowed, you know, according to the law of the land, to use deception to prove deception. They're allowed to lie to suspects and do so all the time. It's a legitimate form of interrogation according to the U.S. constitutional interpretation. So, yeah, in that context, sure. The question is then whether the confessions are reliable. One of the problems with the lie detector is so often we just take the confessions at face value, whereas, of course, many confessions turn out to be false, and you really need to corroborate them. You need to turn to other forms of evidence to check. People have incredible guilt complexes about all kinds of stuff put in those situations. Recently, in a case, post 9/11 case, a young Egyptian man was strapped into a lie detector and admitted to having had a pilot's radio in his hotel room right across from the World Trade Center.
That's right. You reference this in the book, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do reference it in the book, but it was in the news quite a lot. Turns out it was a false confession. He was totally intimidated, totally frightened. He was afraid his family back in Egypt was going to be tortured, and so he confessed. It was wrong.
Yeah, and yet you also point out that, as we have discussed in this conversation, that the people are willing to go ahead and strap themselves in a polygraph to tell the truth. I mean, you know, even on television if necessary.
Yeah, well, that's where it's in its natural element. I mean, that's the lie detector is pure performance, pure theater. You know, there you are on national TV or, you know, in some dating game. And that level of sort of ritual performance is really what makes what the lie detector feeds on, I think.
So this kind of reality culture, you feel, is again one of these factors that is causing true science, which would be, well, this is junk science, the lie detector. It's causing it to be sort of accepted? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. That's where we are. Truthiness. It's the era of truthiness. I mean, you know, the thing about the lie detector is it doesn't measure what's the truth. It measures what people feel is the truth, right? So it's all about public avowals of sincerity, public avowals of sort of authenticity. And that's a really deep strain in American culture, you know, without even invoking our Puritan and Calvinist, origins in the 17th and 18th century, you know, right through to the McCarthyite period, loyalty oaths, this idea that Americans avow their citizenship in public with these sort of declarations of their sincerity and their authenticity. And that's what the lie detector is perfect at eliciting and reinforcing.
Speaking of this culture, what inspired these detective novel epigraphs that precede each chapter?
Yeah, well, there are a couple things. One is, you know, historians, I'm a historian, and historians are a bit like detectives. And we, too, try to get at the truth. We use evidence. We use written letters, documents. And we also have to watch their emotional slant, as it were, just as, you know, the lie detector guys do. And in a way, I kind of have a kind of sympathy for these guys in a way. I mean, I do think, you know, early on, especially, they're sincere. They want to, you know, elicit the truth. Larson certainly does. And they're trying to read through emotions to get it, quote unquote, the truth. And to some extent, historians have a similar kind of practice. And then think about the noir characters of Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. They, too, are trying to maintain a cool professionalism, right? They're weirdly outside of all institutional life. They're trying to read clues. They're constantly sort of being betrayed by their emotions. They're trying to avoid the femme fatale who's always blocking their way to the truth. And historians and these guys sort of live in that world of trying to discern what's really going on.
Well, William Grimes reviewed this book in the New York Times Book Review, and he accused you of being too intoxicated with the lie detector. I'm wondering if there's some sort of like halfway point between sort of, as in his view, serious history or writing a pop cultural romp, as he sort of suggested that you were doing.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit, not necessarily unfair, but surely a book can do a bit of both, right? In other words, a book could be a serious history book, and it is. It has an argument about why this has been so appealing to Americans, you know, why it's like an IQ test or other sort of neutral and scientific ways of solving contentious social problems have become so popular in America in the 20s and 30s. And yet, of course, you got to go where the story is because it's an incredible story. Also, one other thing. You can give a lot of what his professional historians will call structural explanations. Why, as it were, America proved a very fertile soil for lie detection to thrive. But ultimately, and this is something as a historian I deeply believe, history is made by people. And people act in time, and they push for particular results. And you have to follow the story, because that is how history gets made. I mean, Larson and Keeler and their different views of the lie detector and the clash between them does in some way produce the kind of lie detector we have. There's soil, but there's also seed, right? And it's Keeler's lie detector that ends up triumphing, and you have to understand the story of how he made that work. You have to follow the story, and the story is a noir story. The story is a story of, you know, battling Chicago corruption and, you know, taking it into the Cold War world of the Alger Hiss case. You got to follow the story.
Yeah, well, you also note that the lie detector was used by movie studios and television studios and advertisers to essentially detect emotional reaction from various audience members. In that case, though, it was interesting because it didn't seem to be more so detecting lies, but more detecting their emotions, and this was a sort of a brief period of that. I'm wondering, you know, did Keeler, you know, maybe you could talk about how Keeler possibly allowed something like this to happen.
Well, in a way, that, again, does make more sense for what the lie detector is. All it does is measure your heartbeat, your blood pressure, your breathing depth, and your sweatiness. I mean, you have to remember always that that's all it is. So it's measuring, in some sense, your physiological response. And it's brought in by William Moulton Marston and then other people as well to test people's audiences' responses to movies, but also, as you said, to products, to ads for those products and the like. And in a sense, in the case of the movies, actually, particularly interesting because one of the theories that Marston's teacher, Hugo Munsterberg, had about what acting was and what made movies so incredibly powerful as a way of creating a kind of dream reality, so powerful that it drew audiences in. It seemed, though obviously highly edited art form, highly structured art form, it felt psychologically so real. Was he argued that the actors were themselves physiologically responding. They expressed fear in their face. It's mirrored by the audience. And to some extent, Marston then used the lie detector as a way to, as a kind of physiological index, to what extent are actors and audiences sort of in physiological sync? What is that that makes the movie so incredibly plausible? And he's brought into Universal Studios to help edit films.
Yeah. Well, also, speaking of cultural tie-ins, you also mentioned Earl Stanley Gardner's very relationship with the lie detector. And I would also argue that a lot of the lie detector's rise to prominence in the 1920s had much to do with the current newspaper environment, because there were a lot of confidential-style newspapers, a lot of crime news and things like that. Do you think that these kind of cultural indicators were a significant sort of factor towards the lie detector's prominence and awareness and that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the newspapers that come up with the term lie detector. Nobody in the business calls it that. They call it the polygraph, or Larson had a lovely term, the cardio-pneumo-psychogram. But, you know, it's the papers that make it live. And in a way, yeah, they're into true crime, true confession. And also, the newspapers are setting themselves up as the sort of tribunes of the people. There's a lot of mistrust of law enforcement in this period. There's a lot of sense that the law is slow. The law is, you know, kind of procedurally mucked up and isn't really getting to true crime and solving it. I mean, this is the era of prohibition and the like. The idea is newspapers step into the role as, in a sense, crime solvers. Here in San Francisco, you know, Hearst paper, The Examiner, sets itself up as, we're going to solve the cases for you, for the public. And they love the lie detector because it allows them to go right into the criminal mind and solve the problem and the mystery of who committed these heinous acts. And so, yeah, it lives in newsprint. It lives in comic books. That's where the lie detector's in its natural element.
Oh, actually, I wanted to address a question that some poor journalist named Doug Moe, writing for the Capital Times, a Wisconsin newspaper, he wanted to interview you, but he didn't. So I will actually ask the question that he wanted to ask you so that you can get that he could feel vindicated in some
degree. Okay, fair enough.
He asked why you didn't include the investigation of the Annie Lemberger murder and Mae Sorensen's confession, how that kind of, in a weird way, while these other crimes were done by forced confessions and the like, this, in a weird way, led to a resolution of the thing.
I've been perfectly happy to. We just sort of missed each other. But I didn't look in that case. There were a bunch of other cases I didn't look to. There are lots and lots and lots of cases. Partially, you know, it was just a selection on my part of which cases I thought, you know, illustrated the story. But I wouldn't deny that, you know, yeah, the lie detector resolves cases in many, many ways. Again, I'm not denying that. The point is, you want to corroborate, you know, that verification. You don't want to rely on the confession alone.
That's true. That's true. But again, like I said, going back to what we were discussing about device versus coercion, you know, it's this coercive practice that is causing these crimes to be uncovered. Yes, unethically, I would agree, but at the same time, it's like, well, if you're in the position of law enforcement and you've got crime statistics to report to the Bureau and you want to show that, yes, this police bureau is just doing a fantastic job at solving crime, I'm also wondering why you didn't go into this aspect of, like, you know, the police departments and August Vollmer, too, wanting to have, like, the best possible sort of crime statistics, wanting to have, like, you know, crimes lower. And this is the sort of great salvation device. Who cares what the ethics are? It reduces crime.
Absolutely. I think show how they want to get confessions, because confessions is the way they can hand over a criminal case to the prosecutors in the trial phase with a noose around its neck, as it were. I mean, in a way, it wraps up the case, and they definitely want to use it to solve crimes. They really believe in it. I mean, I do think, you know, the flip side of thinking about the lie detector, which I'm doing in this book and in our conversation, is a kind of mechanical placebo, effective largely to the extent you believe in it. Well, the flip side of placebo is self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think in many cases, from the police and prosecutor point of view, that's what the lie detector does. It convinces them of what they kind of already know. And then, well, yeah, on the basis of the confession, they prosecute people. Or if people resist, they don't prosecute them. And so, you know, people are let out who probably are guilty, who beat the test. But people who confess, well, you know, there they go. It's allowed in court, and, you know, the noose is around their neck.
I wanted to actually ask you about the similarities between the rush, this fervor to, like, you know, correct crimes in the 1920s, and currently we have a situation in which Gonzalez is being, you know, basically his feeder to the fire right now, and even Republicans are asking for his termination. So I'm wondering if this... Are there similarities and differences here? What would be the placebo effect today? I mean, waterboarding, or what use of the lie detector there is today? Or?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, there is a definite connection between the lie detector, which you can never be forced to take, but you can be sort of persuaded that you'd be a fool not to take, You know, you might lose your job, you might lose your security clearance, you might have to spend extra time in jail. And, you know, those sorts of actual forms of coercion, psychological coercion, like, you know, stress positions or sleep deprivation, or even out into, you know, things that are really close to physical torture, like waterboarding. Those are all on a kind of continuum. And they all share a common logic, which is the goal is confession, the goal is to resolve it. You know, the goal is to force the truth, that you force it out of the person. In a way, it's like what was once the form of justice in Europe, you know, prior to the period of the French Revolution, you know, which was a kind of judicial torture. You were looking for certainty. You know, judges in the old days, the standard for criminal proceedings sort of prior to 1800 was a kind of world where before you send someone to death, almost all punishment was capital punishment. A good Christian magistrate would want to have certainty that the person was guilty. And so that was why it was legitimate to torture them, because only by torturing them could you get the truth. And torture was like the queen of proof, the sort of final say. But in fact, the law since 1800, for the last 200 years, has actually been probabilistic in its thinking. If you think about terms like beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Or in a civil case, preponderance of evidence. Those are probabilistic terms. Trials and the justice is not about certainty. We can't have it. That's an illusion. And this idea that we would absolutely know what happened, you know, just isn't part of how either science works or the law. It's that dream of certainty and the fact that we could, like, probe people's minds with these psychological techniques and force the truth out that drives us to sort of put these coercive pressures on people. But certainty is an illusion. It's just not how in human affairs you resolve situations. The best you can do is look for evidence that corroborates other evidence, and you build a case, and there's always going to be some doubt. The question is it beyond a reasonable doubt?
And I should also note that some figures in this book actually consider the lie detector to be the replacement for the judicial system, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, if you believe a lie detector and you put it before a jury and the jury believes a lie detector and you know, the lie detector says the defendant is guilty when he's saying he didn't do it, what do you need a jury for? And that's the real reason, in fact, that it's kept out of the courts. It would be overly persuasive to juries, in some sense, replace the juries.
Well, Ken, thank you so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Telling I fled too much.